What's up, Oos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 13. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Nick Carlson, Seth Paul, and Dale Tomps. Tonight, we'll hear stories of creepy children, persistent prisoners, and terminal transferences. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first spine-tingling story. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Cybernetics, computers, robots of the future. Some see it as a benevolent force, expanding our lives, improving our chances in the universe, and leading to a sort of utopia. Others see it as the downfall of civilization, a separation of society into those with enhancements and those without, or simply just death of life as we know it. In other words, a great topic of conversation. Tonight, we're going to see what happens when it all goes wrong. After all, we're all about the spookiness here. Nick Carlson begins tonight with a lovely story of the scientist, his doting family, and of the company that wants to know what he's been up to behind closed doors. Of course, maybe those doors shouldn't be opened in the first place. Without further ado, I present to you The Fruits of Labor. Yerrick was never a creatively endowed man, but the view before him, well, it seemed to tug at some primal urge in his gut, invoking imagery and diction that would have made for some damn good poetry. At least that's what he would assume if he had known better. Dr. Werner Craddock's estate was a Georgian-style manor nestled on a flat, grassy hilltop surrounded by a sparse grove of live oak. Any other time of day, the structure would have looked imposing at the very least. But despite having driven 2 hours through torrential rain, the weather finally clearing up by the time they hit the expansive driveway, the sight was the first thing that had elicited some form of intimidation. The sky had been rendered the burnt orange of evening after a storm, and with the sun setting in the west, it cloaked the manor in shadow, rendering it a black mass of architectural magnitude standing stoically in the dusk. "Damn," his partner Byerma remarked, gazing up at the gloomy facade. "Craddock must be loaded." "He inherited it, from what I've gathered," Yarrick commented, gesturing to the dossier placed in between the seats. "Oh," Byer said, her eyes narrowing. "But considering how much he takes home anyway," said Yarrick, exiting the van, "he could afford 3 more just like it." Byer followed suit, and they headed for the van's back doors, swinging them open to reveal crates and shelves stacked with surveillance equipment, sinister-looking tools, yards of cables coiled on hooks, infrared goggles, and automatic rifles. But all they grabbed was a nondescript silver case fastened to the floor. "This all feels like overkill," said Byer, closing the doors. "I mean, calling us for a job like this? Does Craddock have private security?" "Just a burglar alarm," Yarrick grunted, walking up the driveway to the front doors. "Child's play." "I don't even think that's necessary," said Byer, pointing. "Look." Parked 20 feet from them, near the front of the house, was another white van, but it was smaller and plastered with a conspicuous logo. "Handy stand, appliances and more. Just call. We'll do it all." Yarrick came to a halt. "Why weren't we informed there'd be a repairman on site?" "And why would Craddock schedule one on a week he's not here?" Byer added. Yarrick grimaced, striding up to the driver's seat window. "Coincidence? I don't think Craddock exactly planned what happened to him." He peered through the glass. The van was unoccupied. "And this guy's probably inside the manor. Great. Now we have an added covert element." At first, the task Yarrick and Byer had been hired to execute seemed simple, ignoring the details behind their client and their circumstances. According to the dossier, Dr. Craddock was a top field executive at Novolog, a transnational biotech firm, performing groundbreaking work in nanotechnology until his sudden and unprompted trip to Munich a week before. Intel gathering informed Novolog that Craddock had suffered an undisclosed medical episode that left his prognosis indeterminable. This paired with internal suspicions that Craddock had been for years siphoning company resources for an alleged private project that had prompted Novolog themselves to reach out to Yarrick and Byer to break into the man's estate and ascertain exactly what that project was while the doctor was out of commission. By all accounts, sneaking in, transferring files off a personal computer, and sneaking out ought to have been a cinch. "We'll tack on an adversity fee," said Yarrick, stalking up the front steps. "We can't let them think we'll tolerate these surprises." "Adaptation's part of the job," said Byer, removing a metallic box the size of a brick from the silver case. Yarrick pushed on the heavy oak door. It creaked forward slightly. "No need. Looks like the alarm's been deactivated." Byer raised an eyebrow, stashing the signal jammer back in the case. "Honestly, they could have just paid some high school kid $100 to do what we're doing." "Let's just hope we don't have to knock out a repairman while we're here," said Yarrick, slipping through the door. "Speaking of which," he added, lowering his voice, "can you look him up?" Byer pulled out her smartphone and began browsing. Yarrick looked around. The foyer was spacious and cold, with checkered tiling, mahogany walls, and a postmodernist chandelier the size of a small car hanging from the ceiling. A grand staircase led to the level above, its banisters guarded by carved wooden lions. Even the slightest footstep sent a whispering click through the place. The silence was oppressive and staticky, like white noise sizzling in the subconscious. Yarrick listened out for signs of the repairmen, clinking tools, voices, chugging machinery. But even despite every door on the lower level being closed, he heard nothing. They're small, family-owned, buyer conveyed. It looks like it's just Stan Simpson and his son Joe. Are they local? Yurik asked. She scrolled for a moment more. No, she confirmed. They're like 2.5 hours out, Yurik scowled. What would he call a small business over 100 miles away for whatever's wrong at his house? Maybe they offer good rates, Bayek quipped. This just keeps getting more interesting, Yurik muttered, heading for the stairs. Well, if they're far and away or on a lower level, they shouldn't be an issue. He hesitated. But let's get this over with. This place doesn't feel right. Bayer nodded and followed him up. A massive stained glass window consumed the wall on the second floor, an abstract pattern of blues and reds that reminded Yurik of neurons and subatomic particles. Night hadn't entirely fallen, but the light gleaming in the window was already dimming, ceding the glow of oceanic fire to the impending skeletal gray of twilight. Yurik preemptively drew his flashlight. This way, Bayer whispered. The two crept down the left hallway, away from the window and into the gloom. Portraits stared down at them from the walls, their milky expressions stern and judgmental, like antiquated ghosts. They passed through a door at the end of the mall into an auxiliary foyer. A lone lamp on a nightstand lit up the meager room, adorned with nothing else except a Persian rug, another pair of double doors, and a staircase leading down to some other section of the lower level. Yurik shuffled toward the stairs and lowered an ear. No misplaced sounds drift up from below. Still nothing, Yurik commented. The way I see it, we're just another pair of contractors, said Bayer, striding over to the door. It was only then Yurik heard something that shouldn't have been. Bayer must have heard it too, that subtle, gluey squish. She froze, lifting her boot off the carpet. What in the... reflected... In the muted glow of the lamp was a clear, viscous liquid coating her soul. Looks like Vaseline, said Yurik, observing the amorphous patch of wetness on the carpet. Bayer caught a dab on her flashlight and brought it to her nose, taking a whiff. She was silent for a moment. Her eyes misted over. Bayer, said Yurik, what is it? It's not Vaseline, she said. It smells like... Her brow furrowed. Like what? Yurik prompted. Nothing, I'll tell you later, she said, pocketing the flashlight and stepping up to the door. Yurik blinked. Bayer, seriously, what was that? She tugged on the doorknob, which was locked. Yurik, seriously, she parroted. I'll tell you after we're out of this house. Yurik merely grunted. As long as the substance wasn't toxic, it really mattered little what it actually was. Bayer removed an electronic lockpick from the suitcase, triggering it emphatically. It responded with a high-pitched whir. At least we actually get to do something now, she said, inserting the lockpick and a needle into the keyhole. Another whistling whir and a few clicks followed. Done. The doors swung open before Dr. Craddock's study. An old-fashioned den of madness. Yurik swept his flashlight beam, cutting through the shadows. Chalkboards bursting with equations and terminology indecipherable to the uninitiated. Shelves loaded with specimen jars, their occupants soaking in alcohol or pickling brine. Tables strewn with lab equipment, syringes, petri dishes, and electronic tablets. At the far end of the study, overseen by an upscaled portrait of a bespectacled man with an evocative curl in his left eyebrow, was a desk topped with 3 monitors. Yurik slid the doors closed behind them. In and out, said Bayer, unsnapping the case and taking out a laptop and a portable hard drive. You think we should just transfer the C drive's entire contents? I think so, said Yurik. Novolog can sift through the files themselves. Hear, hear, she concurred, pulling out a can of what looked like spray paint. She aimed the nozzle at the keyboard on the desk, hosing it down with a vaporous hiss. After a moment, certain buttons presented a jaundiced yellow color, the most frequently pressed keys, betrayed by its user's own oily fingerprints. While Bayer hooked up their laptop to Craddock's PC, Yurik examined the den further. Twin bookshelves flanked the double doors. Close examination revealed a thick layer of dust across them. The titles ranged from leather-bound classics to medical textbooks. "Guy hasn't had much time to read lately," he concluded. "Work or life?" He turned his attention to the topmost shelf. It was occupied by a diploma, a college yearbook, and a handful of sentimental knickknacks. But the only object not covered in dust was a face-down picture frame. Yerrick reached up and overturned it. The stark white glow of his flashlight revealed the doctor and his wife, her curly black hair and infectious smile illuminating the scene, and a kid no older than a year or two hanging from her arms. Wispy blonde hair flattened his crown, displaying his own gummy attempt at a smile.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Yerrick's awkward angle made focusing on the picture's finer details difficult, but something about the picture seemed off. He shimmied the frame off its shelf and held it closer to his face. Yes. Something was definitely wrong. He felt it more in his stomach than his brain, something primitive and animal warning him to flee and stay away. That was simple, said Bayer, startling Yerrick, who nearly dropped the picture. Rory 2018. Probably could have guessed that myself without a descrambler. I'm assuming that's his kid? And positive it is, Yerrick murmured, refocusing on the picture. After a moment's perusal, he set it back on the shelf the way he found it, the new revelation thoroughly unnerving him. "How far are you, Narya?" "Just got to crack the encryption and I can transfer the files," she relayed. "Just for grins," she tapped a tentative guess. "No way. Rory, 2018. Again. Guy must really love his son. Did you know he had a kid?" "It wasn't in the dossier," said Yerrick. "I don't think anyone at Novolog even knew, but I think I might have an idea as to why. Look at this." Bear stepped away from the computers and joined Yerrick at the bookshelf. He reached for the picture frame again and handed it to her. She scrutinized it under her flashlight beam. "Why are his eyes like that?" she finally asked. "I don't know," said Yerrick. "The baby's eyes were black as a shark's. The sun reflected them, like two tiny white pinpricks. He might have resembled a doll if not for the silly, sloppy grin, which more and more resembled some cave-dwelling creature's gaping maw. Maybe he was sick." "Was?" "Just a hunch," said Yerrick. "But if his son had passed away from some illness, that could have spurred his erratic behavior and maybe this project." "Very astute." The new voice was cutting and low like a serrated knife. Dropping the frame, Yerrick scrambled for his sidearm, but a spray of chemical fog blasted them in the face, catching him mid-breath. Immediately, his head went fuzzy. Yerrick staggered against the bookshelf, attempting to aim the gun at the tall, lanky figure standing by the double doors, but the fuzz became blackness and he slumped painfully to the ground, the gun tumbling from his limp fingers. The figure crouched and leaned over his ear as he slipped into unconsciousness. But wrong. The smell was striking enough to rouse Yerrick. It was familiar yet propulsive, flinging him back to childhood, that bite of bleach, ammonia, and faintest suggestion of mold. He knew he was at the bottom of a drained swimming pool without opening his eyes. Even the chill on his skin was evocative. The frigid, wet air of a dank locker room while you change back into your day clothes after 2 hours in the lukewarm pool. That confused him, though. He sat up, finding himself and Bear in opposite corners of the 10-foot section, flooded in a half-inch of standing water. The source of the invasive cold was apparent. They'd both been stripped down to their undergarments. Yerrick broke his gaze and looked around. The concrete walls were mottled gray and slippery, rimmed with an Atlantean blue pattern near the top. Only a single halogen light above illuminated the pool room, casting everything in a sickly greenish-white hue. barrier. Yurik rasped. She stirred, sitting up, head listing to the side. The bastard drugged us. She looked blearily in his direction. And stole your clothes, apparently. Yours too, he mumbled, gesturing weakly. She glanced down and flinched. Creep. You don't think he... I don't know, said Yurik, flexing his limbs. Are you hurting anywhere? No, said Bear. I think he only dumped us here. Then why? Humiliation? Yurik looked up and around, wincing despite the low light. Because if he thinks this would humiliate me, he has no idea what I had to stick my hands in before. Oh, I think I have an idea. Dr. Werner Craddock's pallid face was like a phantom at the rim above the 3-foot section, seeming to float in the murk. I can only assume Nogolog sent you goons to pilfer my work in my absence. The room's acoustics rendered his voice an echoing eerie hiss. Thankfully, they didn't count on me returning the same day. Yurik forced himself to stand, fighting the headache left over from the doctor's chemical spray. Craddock, what the hell is this? He barked. The bounty, said Craddock. He'll be most happy to have you two. What are you talking about? Yurik shouted as Bear stood up. What happened in Munich? They said you had a medical episode. Precisely what I wanted them to relay, said Craddock, nodding. I feel great, by the way. In fact, literally, never in my life have I been better. Listen, said Yurik, advancing toward the slope separating the depths. We're hired to do a job. We have no quarrel with you. Don't make me have to... The doctor withdrew his hands from behind his back, revealing their sidearms in his grasp. I, however, have a quarrel with you. You broke into my house and attempted to compromise the integrity of my project, all for what I can only assume is a modest compensation. You have no idea what breakthroughs I'm on the cusp of. To sabotage my work could mean the end of the world. The end of the world? Said Bear, walking up next to Yurik. What does that mean? What were you doing in Munich? Far beyond the confines of the pool, something emitted a piercing scream. The doctor jumped and peeked over his shoulder, his arms tensing. I've made mistakes, he croaked, the arrogance drained from his voice. No. He paced the edge of the pool, talking to himself. Not a mistake, a lesson. One step forward in understanding. The scream happened again. He's famished, the doctor stammered. I've never heard him this upset before. I thought... Who? Yurik demanded. Craddock, what is that? In the distance, a new sound emerged, something heavy and wet crawling across the tile flooring. And with it came a smell, something pungent and oddly sweet. Yurik's eyes flickered over to Bear, her face lit with horrific recognition. Vernix, she whispered. That's what that was. The thing was dragging itself closer. Yurik could hear its breathing, ragged, high, congested, with phlegm. Craddock aimed the sidearms at them. You stay there. But he glanced over his shoulder again and staggered away from the pool. I'm sorry. I can't watch. Then, nearly tripping over himself, he bolted out of sight. Craddock! Yurik shouted, rushing up the slope. Something, huge and misshapen, emerged over the edge of the pool, freezing him in place. It seemed to grow inexplicably, never stopping. It then keeled over and fell into the 3-foot section with a sickening, gelatinous crash. Yurik's legs were liquid, his heart a jackhammer rupturing his chest. He stumbled backwards, scurrying back to the 10-foot section. The thing lay in a heap of chubby flesh, fingers and toes, at the front end of the pool. Then, unfolding like some propagating slime mold, it rose to its feet. It was the blonde hair that caught Yurik's eyes first, a frail golden comb-over plastered to its scalp. Everything below it was abhorrent, perverted, monstrous, wrong. An 8-foot toddler, bulging eyes black as pitch, its wrinkly, peachy flesh marred with gleaming metallic patches. Clumps of fiberglass filaments coated its body like wet hairs, dripping with a gluey, translucent substance reeking of vernix. Its jaws distended, His teeth were a clustered rosette of broken glass. With a shriek, it staggered towards them. Each footstep crunched and squished as if it were crushing 1,000 bugs. It pitched and swayed unsteadily, as if it would kill over at any second. But its path was true, and it was closing the gap. Yerk snapped out of it. He and Bear flattened themselves against the back wall, adrenaline surging through his muscles. He'd faced opponents in hand-to-hand combat before, but never aberrations like... And suddenly, it was in the 10-foot section, its grubby hands swiping at Bear, its lips contorted into a wide smile. Screaming, she drove a kick into the creature's diaphragm, but her foot glanced off its ribs as if they were made of stone, and she fell. Undeterred, it grabbed her with a jubilant cry. Yerk roared and charged, throwing his full weight into a punch that he sent into its flabby back. Its skin seemed to tighten and repel his momentum, brushing his knuckle and nearly throwing his arm out of its socket. He stumbled and ran into the side wall, stars clouding his vision. Bear's screaming hit a doomed pitch. The creature had lifted her into the air like a favorite toy, saliva dripping from its lips as it ogled her greedily. She kicked and struck, struggling in its grasp. It laughed, some choked, demonic parody of a baby's laugh. Bayer screamed all the way into its mouth, her voice reverberating in the back of its throat. It bit down. Flesh split and neck bones cracked as she grabbed at the skin on its face. But it yanked her body from its jaws with a ripping crunch. It swallowed, its throat distending as Bear's head traveled down its gullet. Blood geysered from her neck, staining her body with streaks of red. The creature shrieked with laughter again as it continued to feed. The sloppy, mashing noises finally broke Yerrick, and he turned away and vomited on the floor. His seasoned brain was a smoking, grinding machine. Fatal. No chance of recovery. Create distance. Save yourself. His traitorous body refused to move. Get out of there, he growled at himself, forcing his legs to move. It was a shaky, shambling run, but he ascended the slope regardless, the sounds of jubilant mastication diminishing behind him. Once he hit the 4-foot mark, he pivoted and climbed up the side wall, dragging himself above the edge of the pool. Still, he forced himself to run, to not look back and delay his escape. The pool room was strewn with overturned tables and chairs, noodles and floaties spilling from a destroyed plastic chest. The sweet stench of vernix still clogged his nostrils. Groaning, he practically threw himself into a windowed door leading into a hallway, bursting it open, falling into the dark-carpeted antechamber, and slamming it shut with his foot. The sounds and smells were gone. Only then could he hear his own breathing, his pulse pounding in his ears, and the taste of foul acid of bile in the back of his throat. Yet all that he could see was the hideous scene transpiring in the bottom of the drained swimming pool. That deformed, outsized biotechnic infant, wielding his colleague and teammate's corpse around like a plaything, her half-nude form marred with streaming bloody stripes like some sort of esoteric art piece. He retched again, his body spasming with dread and disgust. It was not the ideal introduction to whom he now knew was Rory Craddock. Under different circumstances, the Craddock Estate's basement level might have been a perfect place to host a party, creeping through the dark hallways, his eyes adjusting to the low ambient light. Yerrick came across a billiards room, a dining room with a bar, a home theater, and an arcade room filled with slot machines and classic Atari games. But all Yerrick wanted was an escape. There was no sign of a stairwell, and every window was barricaded and blacked out. And the more he looked, the more he saw signs of Rory's presence, gouges in the paint, dried stains of that gooey substance he used, toppled furniture, holes in walls. The whole space reeked of mildew and stale piss. Containment, he realized, reaching a dead end. They're keeping him alive, feeding him for whatever project Craddock is involved with. There had to be a staircase or a dumbwaiter. Some way the doctor got two unconscious adult humans down from his study to the basement level. but Yurik had scoured every room on this side of the estate, and nothing had remotely resembled a way up. The only other option was whatever lay beyond the other side of the pool room, back in the direction of Rory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bayer's voice spoke up in his mind. Adaptation's part of the job, he repeated. His bare feet were making zero noise in the floor, regardless of the texture, and his exposed skin meant heightened senses and no clothing to drag or catch on anything. In the past, most of his jobs had required confrontation over stealth, but all his training and instincts were honing in on making himself invisible. The playing field might have been leveled against him, but ideally, he could sneak entirely through the basement and find his way up without Rory ever knowing. He'd faced more objectively dangerous challenges, but the stakes had never been higher. His life, the damning revelation of the Craddock Estate's horrors, avenging his dispatched teammate. He had to get out. As he turned around and made his way back down the halls, his heightened senses proved themselves effective. He could hear the snuffling and scratching of rodents in the walls. He paused, audibly observing their progress. Strangely, they seemed to localize to one closet off to his right, and the harder he listened, the more he suspected they weren't rodents at all. He turned to the closet and tapped on the door. The noises stopped. Yurik placed his ear to the crack. It was faint, but it was, without a doubt, human breathing.
"Hello?" Yurik whispered. "Hey," a crackly voice whispered back. "Who is that? Werner?"
"No, thankfully. I'm here to help." Yurik heard the occupant stand up, walk over to the door, and unlock the deadbolt. It eased open to reveal a stout, pale-faced old man with tufts of gray hair wearing a dark janitorial outfit. "You're Stan Thompson," said Yurik. "Yeah," the man confirmed. His eyes were wide, even in the low light. Yurik could see they were tinted red. "Who are you?" "That's not important. But I'm a contractor commissioned to do a job at this house, just like you."
"Oh."
Stan nodded listlessly. "Werner Craddock. He booked us a week ago about the filtration system for his pool. We'd never done those before, and he was very far out, but he was willing to pay extra, plus double the travel expenses. We couldn't say no to a client like that."
"How long have you been here?" Yurik asked.
"Hours, at least. Most of it in this room, hiding from..." Stan's face scrunched up and he swallowed back tears.
"What's going on? What is that thing?"
Yurik grimaced. "That thing is his child, Rory, whom I'm certain is part of some grand secret project. And I'm also certain he called you over not to fix his pool, but to be food for it." Stan gave a moan of despair.
"Oh, God.
Did your son come with you?" said Yurik. Stan's face flushed. Fresh tears welled up in his eyes. "When that thing attacked, we separated. I ran. I'm such a..." His eyes closed and his head twitched.
"Coward."
"Shh," Yurik urged. "Right now, my priority is to get you out of here. If we find Joe, we'll grab him too, but this comes first." Stan sniffed, but he straightened up and followed him out. He walked with a noticeable limp.
"Really, though, what are you, some kind of mercenary?"
"Well, that's the closest term for it," said Yurik begrudgingly. "Do you normally do your missions in briefs?" "Only one time, Catalonia, a honeypot operation, soliciting proof that a prominent cleric was a homosexual. And no, I won't go into detail." "That's fine by me."
The two men stalked the shadowy halls back in the direction of the pool room. An untrained, out-of-shape older man with a limp screamed liability to someone like Yurik, but he needed corroboration and proof of what Craddock was hiding. And privately, if he could save one person from this hellhole, it might make up for the one person he'd lost. The window door opened to the pool room, that was in the distance, a dimly lit rectangle of light permeating in the dark. "Hold," Yerrick said. "Let me scope the room. We'll be out in the open." Stan paused, giving a meek flick of his hand. Yerrick strode down the hallway and paused by the window, peering through the glass. The pool room appeared empty, and there was indeed another door in the opposite end. But Yerrick could also see into the 10-foot section, and the bloodstain splattered against the concrete wall, and a red, dripping trail leading from the slope to the 3-foot section, up the pool steps, and back toward the opposite door. "We can loop them," he concluded. The pool room would leave them exposed, but the creature's top speed was little more than a jog, and if he could get Stan far enough ahead of it, they could make some distance and hide again. Music suddenly exploded from behind him, a lullaby, something that would accompany a mobile, but ear-bleedingly loud and distorted. Yerrick jumped, his head screaming from the sheer volume. He whipped around to find another room had lit up back down the hallway where Stan Simpson had been. Groaning with aggravation, he bolted in the direction of the light and found Stan in the middle of a storage closet filled with containers and boxes, a fluorescent bulb swaying above his head. The man had his ears clasped to his head. "I thought I heard him in here," he shouted over the music. "I thought..." "Shut up," Yerrick commanded, grabbing the old man's forearm. "We have to move. Let's go." The distant pool room door smashed open. Rory was silhouetted against the light, his bulbous form eating up the space within the doorframe. He gave a mirthful cackle and charged. "Split up!" Yerrick shouted. "Away from the light!" The two men scrambled into the darkness. Yerrick ducked into a side room, forcing his eyes to adjust. He laid his hand on the wall and felt his way down the hallway. He glanced off a piece of furniture, emitting a noisy wooden clunk. Somewhere out of sight, Rory gave an inquisitive whine. His hapless footsteps drew closer down the same side room. Yerrick stemmed his breathing and crept further away. He could hardly see, but Rory's various sounds clashed horribly with the psychotic lullaby still piping from the closet storage, and that smell was back, doughy and bodily and sickly sweet. Yerrick backed into a dresser drawer. Something atop it wobbled from its momentum. He felt three separate walls boxing him in. In front of him, Rory turned a corner. The creature's body filled the enclosed room. His fetal skin seemed to give off a faintish pink glow. The stench was stifling, almost intoxicating. Yet those glassy eyes and the messy orifice of his mouth stood out black on pale. His eyes offhandedly reminded Yerrick of hatchetfish, especially adapted for low-light conditions in the abyss. He wondered if Rory could see him, or if he had developed enough to see even that far ahead of his own face. Regardless, the mutant child took plodding steps forward, babbling incoherently. A murky smile loomed in the dark. Yerrick reached behind him, grabbing at the object on the nightstand. His sense of touch told him it was a vase, antique, maybe, by the grooves and contours, but it was heavy and throwable. Rory was barely 6 feet away. Yerrick could hear viscous fluid smacking in his mouth. Bellowing, he hurled the vase with all his strength. The vase shattered directly on Rory's lips, and before the shards could even fall, Yerrick had already squeezed past him and back toward the main hallway. Rory shrieked, clawing at his mouth, staggering in pain and bouncing off the side walls. His frantic motion shook the foundations, his footfall a chorus of sledgehammers. Yerrick finally emerged into the hallway, sprinting for the pool room, and to his relief saw Stan in the distance, hobbling for the opposite door. Yerrick tore through the room, the light searing his pupils, trying not to look into the 10-foot section, where what little remained of Bear. He burst through the door and slammed it shut, muffling the lullaby and Rory's distant agony. "Simpson!" he called out. He walked down the new hallway, head on a swivel. "Where'd you go?" He wondered if the man had already found the exit and taken it for himself. Yerrick supposed he wouldn't blame him, but just ahead of him, another side room's lights turned on, and once again the lullaby blared through. "It's a goddamn alarm system," Yerrick spat. rushing for the room.
Idiot!
He rounded the doorway and found himself in a spacious tool shed, lit by a single old-fashioned light bulb and accompanied by the scents of sawdust and motor oil. Stan kneeled in the center of the floor. Yerrick immediately spotted an exit door at the far end, and he immediately coursed for it, fiddling with the doorknob. To his surprise, it creaked open, only to immediately stop against the barricade.
God damn it, he cursed.
Stan, find a tool. Help me get this. But from his angle, Yerrick saw what Stan was kneeling over. A ripped, discarded janitorial uniform like his, adhered to a dried pool of blood. The man's hands trembled. His lower lip quivered. His muted sobbing was drowned out by the music piping above.
Stan,
Yerrick said softly, but he couldn't even hear his own voice.
Stan!
Please, we have to move. The old man shook his head. He'd picked up the bundle of clothes and pressed them against his chest.
Hell,
Yerrick growled, a pang of grief in his heart. He strode past him and slammed the workroom door shut. A lullaby drove sonic spikes into his ears as he milled about the shelves for a suitable weapon. From beyond, wet, clotting footsteps arrived outside the door. Yerrick drew further away from the hallway. He scanned desperately, passing over handsaws, trowels, mallets, until he eyed an axe leaning against a workbench. One blow to the skull, he resolved, brandishing it and facing the front door. He could hear it breathing outside, his arms tensed. A gravid moment passed. Stan stood up, the uniform bundled like an infant, his teary eyes trained on the axe. The music continued to drone on, then abruptly stopped. The click of an intercom followed.
"Rory, sweetheart, you can go inside the workroom," a woman's voice said. "Daddy's not here right now."
Immediately, the door smashed open. Rory stood there, his bulging eyes screwed up in agony, his lips swollen over his jagged teeth.
No way, Merrick thought, staring up at the speaker mounted on the wall. Someone else was down here with...
The axe was wrenched from his hands, murder in his eyes. Stan emitted a tear-choked bellow and swung at Rory's skull, but his bad leg gave out and he stumbled, and the axe struck Rory's chest. The creature screamed, but he yanked the axe from his skin and flung it aside. Yerrick observed the wound, shallow and all but bloodless, as if someone had slashed him with a simple steak knife. Rory's face turned beet red with fury. He shoved the old man to the ground and threw himself on top of him, beating him with his hammy fists, each impact punctuated with a high-pitched grunt of rage. The man swiped at Rory's ears, his cheeks, but his efforts were half-hearted despite everything. With one last angry smash, Rory cracked Stan Simpson's skull, spilling nuggets of brain and bone across the wooden floor. Amid the carnage, Yerrick slipped past them and into the darkness.
Someone's directing him, caring for him down here.
The realization was just another thick, stinking layer to it all. This section of the basement was scarcely different than the previous one, apart from the sounds of a smashing mouth and infant wrath, mercifully fading into the background the further he pushed. On the job, emotions were little more than a barrier for Yerrick. Whatever morally dubious initiatives he'd been assigned necessitated leaving all those pretenses behind him. But the twisted, familial network spun by the Craddocks, the culmination of those perversions waddling through the derelict basement of their estate, the lives lost to sustain it, thinking back to Craddock's project, all Yerrick saw were Stan Simpson's eyes, tinged red with fury, swinging an axe with no less than a burning malintent to inflict the same pain he'd felt on another being. So much more than pretty corporate espionage, he realized. Craddock was fostering an abomination of what little good remained in this world. He would escape and blast the truth from mountaintops, ruin Craddock, eliminate Rory, sink whatever project the doctor had lied and kidnapped and killed for. But it would be next to useless without information. Context. Surely the doctor would have destroyed their equipment and hard drives by now if he hadn't already disabled their van. Yerrick whispered hushed curses to himself.
feeling truly naked for the first time since coming around in the bottom of the pool. Turning a corner, a potential answer lay ahead. A single closed door in the darkness, whitish light seeping from the cracks. Yerrick listened out for Rory, but the child appeared to have quieted down or moved elsewhere somewhere. He walked toward the door, quietly turning the handle and pushing it open. He had a theory about who he'd find behind it. Still, the scene caught him off guard. It was a playroom, upholstered with colored rubber tiles, its walls painted sky blue with cartoon clouds, and a sun smiling, looking over it. The same lullaby played overhead in a much gentler, soothing tone. Oversized plastic building blocks had scattered across the floor. Giant stuffed animals, the kind you'd blow $40 on at carnival games trying to win, occupied the corners. Each one had incurred some degree of damage. Puffy felt limbs squeezed and torqued into flattened husks. Rotund guts ripped open, lined with frayed stitches, bursting with loose stuffing. Entire heads ripped off, some missing their black button eyes. The playroom smelled of Rory, but otherwise the toys and surroundings were clean and somewhat organized. Someone was maintaining it. Closing the door behind him, Yerrick observed the far wall, halfway taken up by a mirror. He looked worse than he thought. Grimy skin speckled with dried blood, hair a frenzied mess, fresh stubble clouding his complexion. But Yerrick knew a one-way window when he saw one. Scanning about the far wall, he saw the outline of a door to the right of the glass, painted over to blend in with the decor. Yerrick stepped up to the window, staring through it at its unseen spectator. "I know you're there," he declared. "I don't have to hurt you. All I want is answers. Let me in." The lullaby continued to loop. Yerrick peered through the glass, the small, stupid possibility of him being truly alone, in the playroom, tapping his shoulder. Then came the sound of a lock disengaging. Yerrick pressed on the outline, and it creaked open on a hinge. The observation chamber was a dark, confined space, little more than a broom closet. Three stools lined a countertop bordering the window. The farthest one from Yerrick was occupied. A monitor and a control panel illuminated her. A haggard woman with stringy black hair, her face sunken and thin. Behind her, taking up the available space, was a simple mattress and a thin blanket. In her lap was a 12-gauge shotgun. Yerrick studied her face. The last time he'd seen it, it was enraptured with a smile, joyous and full. But the picture had been taken long ago, before the twin ravages of time and circumstance had conspired to lay several extra years on her. "Mrs. Craddock," said Yerrick, easing the door shut. "Jenna," she said, her voice identical to the one over the intercom. "You're the first one who's gotten the better of Rory. Least of all, found my room." "Your husband hasn't dealt with someone like me before," he said savagely, sitting on a stool and facing her. "Innocent handymen are probably easy pickings for that thing. Still, though, it killed my partner. It's dangerous. It's an absolute monstrosity, and you would have let it kill me, too. Actually, scratch that. You compelled it to." "I know," she breathed, shaking her head. "And it's not so awful when you can't see them. Only the light fixtures they trigger." She motioned toward a grid on a control panel studded with tiny orange bulbs. Yerrick couldn't read the labels on them, but he deduced they matched a different room in the basement level. "But he's my son. My boy's got to eat, too." Yerrick leaned forward. "Start from the beginning. Whatever work your husband was doing, how did it lead to that thing? What was he doing in Munich? I want to know. Then," he added threateningly, "I'll decide what happens next." Jenna grimaced, her grip on the shotgun tightening. Then she swiveled in her seat and scribbled something on a notepad, sliding it across the countertop toward Yerrick. "Have you seen this symbol before?" Yerrick glanced at it. A lowercase h with a superscript plus sign enclosed in a circle. "I'm unfamiliar." Transhumanism, Jenna explained. It's what motivated Werner and I since we first met. Emergent technologies to find a cure for the human condition. Novolog was already investing in nanotechnology to fight cancer at the cellular level. But Werner wanted to take it a step further. He wanted nanobots to work at the genetic level, rearrange our very genomes to build desirable traits and fix undesirable ones. Such initiatives were already marked in the roadmap, but not soon enough for him. He's fanatical. Brilliant, but fanatical. As she spilled her guts, Yerk's eyes darted around the room. Obscured by the darkness but detectable regardless, was a large square hatch on the wall to her left, the entrance to a dumbwaiter. His gaze flicked to the shotgun still in her hand. A plan brewed feverishly in his mind, but he had to let her speak, to bring about closure. "Imagine what we could do with such technology," she continued. "Nullify physical and mental handicaps just by targeting a few genes with nanobots. We could literally write out sickle cell anemia, Down syndrome, early onset Alzheimer's, and not only that, but benefit the patient as a whole. Stronger muscles, sharper vision, maxing out our full potential as a species." "Sounds like eugenics," said Yerk, his eyes narrowing. Jenna shook her head. "No. Eugenics is discriminatory by nature. Werner wants everybody in the world to be better, no strings attached, and he was developing a way to achieve that." She sighed. "He wanted to pass on nanobots through his own genes." Yerk's eyebrows shot up. The pieces were coming together, crawling like the remnants of some amorphous alien blob. The term he coined was, she took a moment to gather her thoughts, generational technological enhancement. Producing next of kin with nanobots already in their genes, propagating in their blood just as their cells would produce molecules, and with the next generation of children, enhanced to their fullest potential, would come an entirely new species of human. One objectively better than the last, who would continue producing enhanced offspring, a perfect vision of man to carry mankind's legacy. "When I mentioned the end of the world was at stake with his research," said Yerk. "He believes mankind must become something better if they're to survive," said Jenna. She straightened up. "As do I. It's a worthy cause. Billions worth of resources wasted on costly diseases, famine, poverty, freed up to secure the fate of our planet and achieve more ambitious goals. And I take it Rory was your first attempt at conceiving one of these nano-children?" Yerk guessed. Jenna's eyes clouded with trepidation. "Werner infused himself 7 years ago. Rory was born in 2018. He was a perfectly fine little boy except for his eyes. His vision was normal for a baby his age, but we guessed it was a side effect of the nanobots in his blood. But the years went on. His proportion remained infantile, and his growth skyrocketed. And when those teeth emerged, he rejected normal food. And Werner discovered that only sustenance of a matching genetic makeup could appropriately nourish him." "Human flesh," said Yerk, a chill running down his spine. Jenna nodded, her lips pursing. "We get by with pigs. Their DNA is remarkably similar to ours in the taste, but it's empty calories. Flesh is the only thing that satisfies." Yerk stood up. Jenna pivoted the shotgun towards him. "So," he said, thinking fast, "I guess you're keeping him around and luring innocent people down here for him because..." Anger spiked in his next words. "He's too valuable an asset." "He's my son," Jenna cried, standing up, pressing the butt of her gun to her shoulder. "I love him. He still deserves to live and grow and see his full potential. And yes, he is valuable, because he's not perfect." "Oh, you don't say," Yerk shouted. "Listen, that substance he secretes, the pseudo-vernix, complete immunity from infectious diseases. and the way his skin contracts against blunt force, the perfect defense. How amazing is that? You can't deny it. There's a lot you can learn from him. He's the most miraculous thing I've ever seen. Her eyes glistened. And I can't let him die. The world needs him. I need him. Varric shook his head. He'll just create more monsters like him. Then we'll try again, she asserted, pumping the shotgun. That's the march of progress, you narrow-minded idiot. And now you can contribute. I know Rory's still hungry. Eric sprung forth, grabbing the shotgun and twisting Jenna's wrists. She screamed, wrenching her injured hands away as he aimed the gun back at her. But she ducked over the control panel and pressed a sequence of buttons. The window retracted into a slot, exposing them to the playroom. Jenna leaned into a microphone. Rory, she said, her voice nearly blowing out the speakers. Playtime! Heavy footsteps scampered in from the distance. Yerrick aimed the gun at the playroom door, but Jenna launched herself at him, scrabbling for the shotgun. He swung around, knocking her against the countertop and back wall, yet she still clung on, grunting and clawing at his face. The playroom door busted open. Rory surged through the frame, chubby arms extended, rushing for the open window. Panicking, Yerrick stepped forward, crushing Jenna's foot. He smashed her in the face with the butt, pivoted and pulled the trigger. The gunshot was an acoustic sword drilling into his brain. The muzzle flash was blinding. The smell of burnt plastic filled the air. And Rory was blasted onto his back, chest oozing with buckshot wounds. Against the ringing in his ears, the oversized baby was crying, writhing on the floor and flailing his limbs. Tears poured from his squinted eyes. Mucus leaked from his nose and mouth. The substance, pseudovernix, glopped over his wounds like the slime of a hagfish, but the blood seemed to flow heavier. Rory! Jenna yelled, vaulting over the countertop and into the playroom. She dashed up to the fallen creature, collapsing to her knees. Son of a bitch! She shrieked at Yerrick. Mommy's here! Mommy's got you! She sobbed, ripping off her shirt and pressing it to his chest. You're all right, baby. You're going to be fine. Still, Rory wailed at the top of his lungs, flopping on the floor with heavy thumps. Yerrick let out a raspy sigh, turning his back on them and activating the dumbwaiter. He crawled inside, curling up into a fetal position, as he pressed a button on the side wall, lowering a door and sending the chute up into the walls. As he ascended to the manor's higher levels, he thought he heard a woman's agonized scream from below. Night had long fallen by the time Yerrick emerged from the dumbwaiter onto the ground floor. The manor was empty and quiet, a respite from the chaos below, and yet every breath seemed like an explosion surging through the vast, shadowy halls. Shouldering the shotgun, Yerrick dashed down the corridor. His surroundings seemed much more opulent, empty and imposing compared to the claustrophobic cavern of the basement level. Lightning and thunder crashed outside, temporarily drowning the manor's interior in white. Yerrick stumbled from the noise, his heart unusually jumpy. The rush of escape, the creeping thrill of drawing closer to safety, normalcy was creeping back in, along with the fear and the existential horror pressing on him. Not out of the woods yet, Yerrick, he scolded himself. But everything was seared into his mind. Bear's headless corpse, the ravenous abomination that was Rory Craddock, Stan's despairing eyes. All of this because of him, he told himself. Escape, preach, ruin. The grand staircase was in sight. Yerrick pushed himself harder, barreling into the main foyer and toward the front doors, where sat freedom and validation. Another flash of lightning revealed a tall, lanky silhouette in the open doorway. Dr. Craddock's lab coat billowed in the wind like some vampiric cape. I'm surprised Rory let you escape, the doctor said sardonically. He didn't, Yerrick seethed, skidding to a halt and brandishing the shotgun. I got out on my own, and your kid's not doing so hot. The doctor's shadowy form fidgeted. He'll live. I don't know, Pierre growled, pumping the gun. He looked pretty rough. The mere act of existence is he's put strain on his form. Craddock snapped. And yet he grows stronger day by day. That's the power of the future. And that's what you'll deny this world if you kill me and slander my initiative. Yerrick's eyes narrowed. Whatever grand, glorious future you're working toward, it's not worth what I've seen. Nor all those others you've sacrificed to that mutant bastard you call a son. I told you I've made mistakes, said Craddock, his tone softening. But we must learn to live with our mistakes and learn from them. I've learned so much from Rory. And if you destroy all that I've done, you destroy the world. You sound like your wife, said Yerrick, pumping the shotgun. As I said before, it's not worth all this. Dr. Craddock sighed, reaching for his waistband. Then I'm afraid I can't let you live. Nor can I. Yerrick fired his gun. Night became day, and a booming crack filled the air as the doctor flew like a rag doll, slamming flat on his back upon the front steps of his manor. Another bolt of lightning threw his limp body into sharp relief. The scent of gun smoke eased Yerrick's nerves. The storm was still brewing outside, but he knew he could all too easily walk to safety, call for an extraction, and unveil Craddock's malicious gospel to the world. The doctor's corpse gave a twitch. Yerrick watched with paralyzed horror as Craddock propped himself up on his hands and knees, then slowly stood up. His chest was riddled with holes that were self-extracting the buckshot, which clattered to the ground at his feet. Blood seeped forth, but it stemmed instantly, leaving only a scattering of small dark stains in the doctor's front. Craddock coughed, spewing up a few more metal pellets. That's what Munich was about, he said with a twisted grin. My colleagues across the pond had realized a new series of enhancements. Now I'm the best I've ever been, the most amazing organism on Earth. I am the future. The doctor drew his sidearm from his waistband and aimed it at Yerrick's forehead. Too bad you won't be around to see it. All Yerrick registered was the click of the trigger and the brief muzzle flash. Then everything went black, and he knew no more. I hope you enjoyed The Fruits of Labor by Nick Carlson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to hear and read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nick-Carlson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/NICK-CARLSON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well, at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, and you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky, and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No.